There are reports that there is no evidence of a direct link between Baghdad and some of these terrorist organizations.
There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Excuse me, but is this an unknown unknown?
I'm not
several unknowns, and
I'm not going to say which it is.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Our next guest is Norman Solomon. He's the author of the book Made Love, Got War: Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, and the new movie War Made Easy, from which I stole many of those great sound bites. Welcome to the show, Norman.
Hey, thank you.
It's good to have you on. I really enjoyed your movie. Did a really great job on that. It's narrated by Sean Penn, out now on DVD.
Yes, the movie is just now coming out for what they call a home video distribution nationwide, and it's on Netflix and Best Buy, that sort of thing. Also, people can go to the web, warmadeeasythemovie.org, and it's based on my book, also the same title, War Made Easy, and the subtitle kind of sums it up, how presidents and pundits keep spinning us to death.
Yeah, to death, literally, indeed. And you can also read all of Norman Solomon's articles at antiwar.com/Solomon. And your movie begins with clips of the end of World War II. Now we will have peace in our time. All the killing is over, and we can put aside our weapons and turn them into plowshares, and everything's going to be just great.
Well, that was the hope, and certainly is sort of a backstory for what was to come in the last 50 years of Vietnam. Of course, the war currently in Iraq as well as Afghanistan, and a lot in between. And what the film does is really reach into the Orwellian memory hole and pull out footage and bits of history and patterns of media coverage that really speak to what I call the warfare state, what we could say is a repetition compulsion disorder, where what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex has dragged and kept the United States into one war after another. And clearly, in 2008, we need to find out ways to change that.
Well, and you know, people always refer to Eisenhower's speech about the military-industrial complex, but and I guess, you know, that's where the phrase was coined. But the war profiteers were a major target of the peace movement between the world wars, and it was understood just how much the arms merchants had to do with the Wilson administration in getting us into the First World War.
Well, you make a very good point, and even in the middle of the Second World War, which, as the film points out, always retained a large majority support in the United States, because most people never came to feel it was based on deception fundamentally. This was a war that, although very popular and a matter of life and death for the survival of democracy in the United States, then-Senator Harry Truman held hearings during World War II on war profiteering. And we need to be willing to look at the reality of how tremendous the profit is for those companies that market, trade in, and make a killing from war, and the contracting to the Pentagon. I mean, let's step back and remind ourselves the U.S. Treasury, which is to say taxpayer money, is funneling $2 billion a day into the military. And a lot of that money sloshing around means extra big profits for some corporations.
Yeah, and, you know, I think of there's a few different articles like this, and actually I think there's probably a lack of real good investigative reporting along these lines, but I know Richard Cummings wrote a great article for Playboy.com called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, where he counted up all the members of the administration who literally worked directly for Lockheed or were lawyers for the company, the law firm that represented Lockheed, or worked for Northrop Grumman. And basically, these are the guys who made the policy. The neocons, basically, I guess, with a tie, as Andrew Coburn says, they're the tie between the military-industrial complex and the Israel lobby. And many of these guys came straight from Lockheed paid positions into the Bush administration.
Well, I think that one of our huge tasks is to find ways to take the profits out of war. Because when we hear how these wars are necessary, at the same time, there's this tremendous financial incentive for some corporations and individuals to gin up the war machine, then clearly there's a contradiction there. It's not only, of course, Lockheed, it's many companies. You have Boeing, for instance, which underwrites public affairs programs, by the way, on PBS, that has tens of billions of dollars a year in revenue, much of it from the Pentagon. And people don't need to take my word for it or your word for it. In the War Made Easy book, I quote many people and many corporations to this effect. I went through the annual reports of small, medium, and large-size U.S. military contractors. And, you know, in annual reports, they're trying to pitch to investors, and they make it very clear they're optimistic that the so-called, although they don't say so-called war on terror, is going to continue. They're optimistic about U.S. bases functioning full tilt overseas. They're optimistic from their vantage point, good that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will continue. And so they keep telling their investors and potential investors in their annual reports, this is looking great. The wars are going to continue.
Oh, man, yeah. Well, and, you know, it's interesting, too, that Dick Cheney, when he was the CEO of Halliburton, used to complain about American sanctions on Iraq and Iran. He wanted to do business with them. It's only when he becomes the vice president and he has access to our Treasury and our Marine Corps that he goes and has a war. I mean, the idea that he would have, as CEO of Halliburton, said to the shareholders, all right, let's raise $3 trillion and invade Mesopotamia and occupy it forever, he'd have been fired in a minute. They'd have laughed him right off the stage.
Well, this is part of the dynamic, and it goes beyond war. It's why I think that corporate power in general has been so corrosive of our democratic possibilities, where the task at hand, whether it's destructive or constructive, like building roads and sewers and infrastructure and dams, these have been projects that are just too massive for corporations to undertake, certainly too massive and expensive for them to want to undertake. So they get the government to do it for them. And I think that this goes to the heart of the question of what is government for anyway? Is it to make a few people wealthy or some corporations wealthy and have a sort of a trickle-down economic dynamic, or is government supposed to be of, by, and for the people for our benefit?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I take a very minimalist view as a libertarian that they exist, if they have a legitimate purpose at all, it's simply to protect liberty, and that means refusing to protect big business from the forces of the market. Let Halliburton compete and make their money, you know, from voluntary exchanges like everybody else, or let them fail.
Well, one question is whether Halliburton and Lockheed and all the rest of them should have a huge subsidy from U.S. taxpayers because of the warfare state. Once you have this enormous investment in the military, then it becomes logical in a perverse way to funnel this huge amount of money to corporations. I mean, this is welfare for the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at, you know, overall goals of government, I think they should include to promote the general welfare that is in our Constitution. It is to my benefit not to have people starving in my country. It is to my benefit to not have children going without health care. It is not to my benefit to have the warfare state perpetuated by the U.S. Treasury.
All right, now one of the things that's most important about well, all of your work, and particularly this movie, it's really the focus, is how they spin us, how important the narrative is to the government getting what they want from us, getting the support they need, the manufacturing our consent, as Noam Chomsky says. And it's really amazing the way you show in the movie how all the presidents going back for generations, on the eve of bombing people with high explosives, always announce that they're only doing this because they love peace so much, because they love the victims so much. And in fact, it even got to the point with this Iraq war where Condoleezza Rice said, listen, if you're against this war to liberate the people of the Middle East, it's because you're the kind of bigot who wanted to keep Rosa Parks at the back of the bus, and you don't believe that Arabs are capable of having liberty and democracy.
Well, there's a lot of arrogance, the idea that the United States is the gift to the world. If our democracy is so great, why did we have this the horrible situation in Florida in 2000 with counting the votes? Yes, there's problems all over the world. There are dictators that people need to get rid of. When the United States subsidizes dictatorship in Egypt, when it trades with and has a military alliance with a horrible dictatorship in Saudi Arabia, and then turns around and says, we want to be in Iraq to promote democracy, it is really hard to believe. And as you say, the War Made Easy film provides footage and evidence and the litany of claims from one president after another, which contrasts with the realities on the ground.
Yeah, it's actually really amazing. In fact, let me go ahead and play a couple of clips like this. Here's LBJ.
I am continuing, and I am increasing the search for every possible path to peace. We want nothing for ourselves, only that the people of South Vietnam be allowed to guide their own country in their own way.
But even as planes of the multinational forces attack Iraq, I prefer to think of peace, not war.
America does not seek conflict.
Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly.
All right, and it just goes on like that.
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing, among other things, the latter voices, the first President Bush and the second President Bush, and it's really notable that, you know, Lyndon Johnson was a Democrat, of course, both President Bush's Republicans, and yet they speak in similar terms. They're trying to defend and promote wars that are based on deception. They fall back on the same sort of rhetoric.
One thing that's, and I'm sorry to be so redundant for the people who listen to all these interviews, but this has just thrown me for a loop, is John McCain talking about Al-Qaeda in league with Iran and so forth. And it brings up the question of just how ignorant these people are in the government and, for that matter, in the media. It wasn't too long ago that some reporters popped surprise quizzes on the incoming head of the House Intelligence Committee and on the head of the FBI Counterterrorism Division and asked them, so what's the difference between Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda and so forth? And they couldn't answer the question at all. And I guess one thing that, well, I've always just thought that these people were dishonest, and I'm realizing more and more just how shallow they really are in their knowledge and even in how much they want to know. And one of the clips in your movie that really got me, I'd like to play it for you here, it's just 14 seconds long. This is from Jim Lehrer. And you know, when I was a kid, my dad always watched the McNeil Lehrer News Hour. This is the most credible news reporter, right? This is our Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America. This is not a blonde-headed, blue-eyed fox on Fox News. This is public television. This is serious news. And here's a clip of Jim Lehrer explaining how it never even occurred to him that they might ask, what's going to happen after we're done invading this country?
Never even looked at the issue of occupation.
Because
it just didn't occur to it. We weren't smart enough. You'd had to go on against the grain.
Right. You'd also come off as kind of a pointy head trying to figure out some obscure issue here.
Yeah,
good guys and bad guys.
Negative.
I mean, and that to me is just really astounding. I mean, if there's anybody in the American media who ought to say, now, General, after the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime, what exactly is the plan? It would have been him, and it wasn't.
Yeah, well, this is the pretense of being in-depth, PBS, NewsHour, with Jim Lehrer. It's a combination of reliance on official sources with an ideological worldview that says, you know, the Americans have the prerogative because we're, after all, more wise and we see the long-term perspectives. Some of these proponents of war are ignorant. Some of them are not. And they have a very sort of calculated view of what their interests are and how they can be best promoted. And I think that's where it ultimately comes down to the need for a combination of values and knowledge. We need both. To know a lot is essential, but not sufficient. We also need to bring to the table values that promote human life over nationalism.
Yeah, well, you know, another thing that's really strange, even to this day in 2008, anybody like yourself who opposed the war in the first place, rather than that being to your credit in the larger sense, that means that you were some kind of ideological Bush-hating crank back then, and it's only people who supported the war who are considered to be reasonable enough to that we ought to listen to them now.
Well, for the most part, that is the case in the U.S. mass media. Being pro-war means never having to say you're sorry, no matter how much in the long run it turns out that you were delusionary, dishonest, or both. And what that means is that the same people who drag us and stampede us into a war in the first place then are relied on as the most credible voices to then say what we do now.
Yeah, you know what's funny? Right now, the Republican nominee for president, John McCain, he was an asset of the Iranian spy, Ahmed Chalabi. For intents and purposes, I mean, not that he, you know, signed on the dotted line and took the job, but he was the dupe of an Iranian spy who lured us into war.
Well, you know, Chalabi is somebody who was the Pentagon's favorite Iraqi exile. He had not been in Iraq for decades. He'd been convicted of bank fraud in Jordan.
His offices were in Tehran.
Well, he's pathologically, at least, let's look at the record, he's lied a lot, Ahmed Chalabi, and yet he was the basis for front page New York Times stories about weapons of mass destruction, alleged links to Al-Qaeda, and all the rest of it. And as you talk about McCain, I mean, here's somebody in recent days shown again, I mean, Al-Qaeda and the government in Tehran, I mean, there's this fundamental split between Sunnis and Shia. And we have this, as you said, you know, yes, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, they have a different alliance structure in the Middle East, very different. And in fact, one of the great ironies is the U.S. government-supported regime now in Iraq, very close, because they're mostly Shia, of course, very close with the Shia government in Iran.
Yeah, it would seem like from the war party's point of view, if they're going to lie to us and pretend that every different group of men with rifles in the Middle East are all somehow part of this one big giant thing, that they would at least try to figure out what the truth was in order to make the lies credible when they're asked to be specific. You know what I mean?
You would think so, but you know they have bigger fish to fry. They have a propaganda machine to run 24/7. They do screw up sometimes. And the net effect is that they're trying to, well, let me put it this way. I went to the Republican 2000 convention. They had a night called Military Night, and the keynote speaker for that night was John McCain. And the rafters of that amphitheater at the 2000 GOP convention shook every time McCain mentioned a past war or a prospect of a future war. This is a sort of a warfare enthrallment that is so powerful. And it certainly exists in both parties, I think you could say objectively, even more so in the Republican Party. And it has dragged us into these wars that have been so destructive in any which way you can mention.
Well, so do you want victory in Iraq or not, pal?
Yeah, that's really part of the media frame. Once we get to that frame and the film goes into that in detail, you know, Bill O'Reilly asked it in exactly those terms, then we're debating the wrong questions. A war based on lies, a violation of international law, can we then be sitting down and saying, how do we make this occupation that was the outgrowth of the war viable and sustainable and winnable? That's the wrong question.
Right, and nobody can even define it. I'm looking at the poll right now, actually. Angus Reid, many adults in the United States continue to question whether the coalition effort can be won, according to a Hart McInturf poll released by the Wall Street Journal and NBC News. 53% of respondents think the U.S. goal of achieving victory in Iraq is not possible. The goal is achieving victory? Well, isn't that just saying the same thing twice? How come they can never define what victory even means?
Well, I think a war at this point is a continuation in search of a rationale. And often the rationales change. It's a bait and switch. It was about weapons of mass destruction. Now that it's known they didn't exist, they have to change the argument.
Yeah, well, it just seems strange to me that you can have a society run by people who are, you know, presumed to be adults, and that we could have... which, you know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound so patronizing,
well,
but
you know,
literally...
They're chronologically adult. They may have a lot of knowledge and a lot of qualities that are positive, but they also, in many cases, people running the government are, it's been said, addicted to war. They can't get away from it. They believe in it. It's part of their identity. It's part of the political economy. As long as structurally it is so profitable to have these wars, we have our hands full stopping them.
Yeah, and I guess that's really the trouble here, is getting people to get that Vietnam syndrome back, getting them to learn the lesson of Vietnam, that empire weakens America, doesn't strengthen us in any way. It's only destructive to us. Maybe it benefits, as you say, the few politically connected military-industrial complex-type corporations, but it's terrible for the rest of us. How do we make the lesson stick where the people don't all fall for it next time?
Well, the so-called lessons of Vietnam promoted by much of the media and certainly the pro-war politicians, they're the wrong lessons. The lessons that we are told are important have to do with, you know, you have to fight better next time, have more weapons earlier, more stifling of dissent at home. That's the 180 wrong direction to, conclusions to draw. We need to build a sustained social justice and peace movement that says that our security has to do with healthcare, education, housing, and the culture of our society, not how many bombs we can drop on other people based on false pretenses to boot. You know, I'd invite folks, and thanks for talking about the film, I'd invite people to go to the War Made Easy, the movie.org website. You can look at the transcript. The whole transcript is posted. You can get the DVD if you'd like. And it's really an educational tool and for anti-war organizing. People having house meetings, they're showing the film in their living rooms, churches, mosques, synagogues, libraries, union halls. It's a tool that can be used. War Made Easy is something that has been mobilized around the country as a video, and we hope it will continue to be useful for building an anti-war movement.
Well, and it's very well done, and it really does take the propaganda from today, and then it rewinds and says, hey, look, here's Lyndon Johnson saying the very same thing. Here's Richard Nixon claiming the very same thing. Here's Bush Sr., and it shows the consistency of the lies of the war party. I mean, let's face it, there's no real enemy that really threatens the existence of the United States anywhere. They have to lie to justify all this murder and all this spending.
Yes, and as you say, there's a kind of a recycling that goes on, and while in environmental terms I'm all for recycling, when it comes to the repetition compulsion disorder to bring the country and keep the country in war, this is a sort of recycling of bogus rhetoric about, you know, you can't cut and run and all the rest of it. We need to challenge that. And the War Made Easy film is a tool that can be used to expose, to probe, to make clear that we are being scammed again and again with horrific results. We need to turn it around.
Another thing that you have in this movie is a focus toward the end on Wayne Morse, who was the only senator or one of two senators?
Only one of two.
One of two senators who voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. And if that's all right, I'd like to play this clip. It's about a minute long here of Senator Wayne Morse from, this is what, 1964?
That's right.
The Constitution gives to the President of the United States the sole responsibility for the conduct of foreign policy.
Couldn't be more wrong. You couldn't make a more unsound legal statement than the one you have just made. This is the promulgation of an old fallacy that foreign policy belongs to the President of the United States.
To whom does
That's
it belong,
nonsense.
Then, Senator?
Belongs to the American people.
All right,
and our Constitutional fathers made it very, very clear.
Where does the President fit into this in the responsibility scale?
What I'm saying is, under our Constitution, all the President is the administrator of the people's foreign policy. Those are his prerogatives. And I'm pleading that the American people be given the facts about foreign
Senator,
policy.
That the American people cannot formulate and execute foreign policy.
Why, you're a man of little faith in democracy if you make that kind of announcement. I have complete faith in the ability of the American people to follow the facts if you'll give them.
It isn't.
And my charge
faith,
against my
Senator.
Government is we're not giving the American people the facts.
We got to back our president. Since when do we have to back our president, or should we? When the president is proposing an unconstitutional act. The
notion. Well, and you know, boy, oh boy, I never get to hear anyone, Norman, say that the Constitution does not give the president unlimited authority in terms of foreign policy. But in fact, I've read Article 2, and it says he gets to negotiate treaties which have no force of law whatsoever unless the Senate ratifies them, and he gets to appoint ambassadors. And then he's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces when called into the actual service of the United States by the Congress. That's it.
Well, you've looked in detail at the Constitution, which seems to be a lot more than most media members have done when they report on congressional debate over war. The fact is, when you look at the Constitution, there is a long list of powers of Congress. And that list includes the power to appropriate money for war. And while it seems to have eluded those in the leadership in Capitol Hill and the major media pundits and reporters, the fact is that if Congress does not choose to appropriate money for a war to continue, that war cannot continue. All Congress has to do to stop this war is to do nothing. to refuse to appropriate funds. Mm-hmm. That is reality.
And further, all legislative powers, that's the first sentence of the Constitution, Article 1, all legislative powers reside in the Congress, and specifically, all the powers concerning the declaration of war and the rules of war and so forth are all right there in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11.
You know, one of the pathetic things to happen has been recently McCain flopping over and being willing to support the White House in its prerogative to torture. You know, we have a Constitution that prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. I would call torture cruel. Maybe Bush is working on making sure it's not so unusual. But this is supposed to matter, and we have so many politicians who just go for expediency. They claim to be mavericks, then they turn around and they just keep signing up for another hitch of a war based on lies.
Yeah, well, you know, Scalia recently said, Justice Antonin Scalia recently said, well, you know, it bans cruel and unusual punishment, the Eighth Amendment, not cruel and unusual interrogation.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's
really
that strict construction I've been looking for.
It's stunning. I mean, you got to be qualified to be a Supreme Court justice to come up. That's worthy of, you know, Stalin or Hitler, that kind of nonsense.
It really is a pretty bizarre world. I hate to use the phrase everybody's picked up on the Superman upside down land or whatever, but it really is strange to hear a Supreme Court justice of the United States of America talking like that.
Yeah, yeah, and it just reinforces the need. Whether it's antiwar.com or one of the hundreds of other organizations, whatever we're working on, we need to build the sort of attitude, information, and institutional structures that are grassroots that can counteract that sort of mentality.
All right, everybody, that's Norman Solomon. He's the author of Made Love, Got War, and War Made Easy, and the new DVD out by the same name, War Made Easy. And you can read what he writes at antiwar.com/Solomon. Thanks very much for your time today.
Hey, thank you.
Trust me. Trust me.
I respect your idealism. I share your concern for peace. I want peace as much as you do.
I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace.
We maintain our strength in order to deter and defend against aggression, to preserve freedom and peace.
No one, friend or foe, should doubt our desire for peace.
The United States wants peace.
We seek peace. We strive for peace.